Good afternoon and welcome to the meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the coast of Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the president of the Forum. Since 1985, the Forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of foreign service, journalism, academia, talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Before I introduce today's speaker, I want to remind our audience of the foreign policy debate between the three candidates to replace Senator Olympia Snowe, Independent Angus King, Republican Charlie Summers, and the Democrat Cynthia Dill. The discussion will be on foreign policy issues solely. It will take place at the Camden Opera House Thursday, October 11th from 6 to 7:30. Doors open at 5 o'clock, and we expect a full house, so get there early. Today, I'm really pleased to introduce Michael Clare. He was here about, he spoke to the forum about 4 years ago and did such a fantastic job that we're delighted to have him back. He's the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Issues at Hampshire College, director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies. He holds a BA and MA from Columbia University, and his doctorate degree is from the Graduate School of the Union Institute. He's written widely on U.S. military policy, international peace and security issues, the global arms trade, and global resource politics. His most recent book is entitled The Race for What's Left, The Global Struggle for the World's Last Resources. You're going to hear about that right now. Michael, we're delighted to have you come on up and let us know what's going on.
Great, thanks. Hello, everybody. I'm very happy to be up here in Maine and to join you again at this event. I'll speak for a while, but I'm really looking forward to your questions because that's the most interesting part, I think, for all of us. So I hope that in my remarks I'll be able to strike some interesting thoughts in your head, get the juices flowing, get us interested in what I think are very important topics. Now, I'm sure that, like me, all of you are often bewildered by the stunning array of international events and challenges that threaten international peace and stability in the world today. Just have to pick up a newspaper and see how many difficult and complex issues there are out there that challenge peace and stability and security around the world. The continuing turmoil in the Middle East and Africa, economic crisis in Europe, which seems to be spreading to the rest of the world, the environmental issues, drought this summer, and of course many other issues, all of which we could spend hours and hours and days talking about. All of them very difficult to understand. And I'm sure if you're like me, you try to find some organizing principle, some framework to try to figure out how to put all of this together, how to explain the many disparate, complicated things that are going on in the world, and even possibly to figure out what to do about this bewildering array of challenges that we see out there in the world. One way to do this would be to apply the kind of bipolar lens that we all employed during the Cold War era to explain everything. During the Cold War, everything, you know, was seen in light of the competition between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And in a way, that was very comforting because it helped us explain everything could be seen in the light of the bipolar struggle. And we know that President Bush, George W. Bush, employed a very similar mode of analysis after 9/11 to explain what was going on in the world. He said we were in a global struggle with international terrorism, with international jihadism, and he used that as a framing device to explain American foreign policy and to shape American foreign policy led to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, to warfare in Afghanistan and all kinds of military involvement in a lot of the rest of the world. And I think that, too, was very comforting for many people in the United States to have a lens to see what was happening in the world. And for some people, that still remains a governing lens, although less so than in the past. Now it seems that many people in Washington would like to apply this kind of bipolar thinking to a new struggle in the world, to see everything in terms of a competition between the U.S. and China. And if you spend time in Washington and listen to the think tank pundits talk about what's happening in the world and listen to the Pentagon officials talk about what's happening, you'll hear a lot about the rise of China and the threat it poses to the United States. There's a real move to recast everything that's happening in terms of a new bipolar relationship. I was in Vladivostok 3 weeks ago for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, and I heard from Hillary Clinton and President Hu Jintao of China and many other officials, and I could hear echoes of this new bipolar thinking. Much of this, of course, is consistent with the school of thought known among academics as realism, with a capital R. Doesn't necessarily mean it's more realistic than anything else, but it's a school of thought. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the realist mode of thought, which holds that every country, every nation must, by nature, will seek to maximize its military advantages, its security advantages, in an ever-going, ongoing struggle with all other rival powers for security and its protection in an unsafe world. And this is another convenient way of thinking about what's going on in the world. And this realist perspective, or a bipolar perspective, is one useful way of thinking about what's happening in the world today. It can help explain some things. It explains, for example, the naval buildup that's taking place in the Pacific as the U.S. and China engage in greater competition for domination of the Pacific region. But I believe this is only one possible explanation for what's happening in the world today, and that there are other ways of understanding what's going on. And in fact, some other explanations can be equally valid and perhaps even more valid depending on the situation. And what I want to talk about today is what I think is an alternative way of looking at the news headlines and the developments that are taking place in the world today. And I use the title of my book as a way of describing that. We could use other names for the same phenomenon. I call it the race for what's left. And what I see taking place in the world is a global struggle over the world's remaining resources. And that this is, in my mind, an equally plausible way of interpreting, describing, explaining what's happening in the world. This perspective holds that at a time of growing world population, growing world industrialization, the rise of a global middle class, accelerating climate change, and insufficiently growing world resources, in fact, the depletion of many world resources, more and more of world affairs are governed by intense competition among major industrial powers for what remains of the world's vital resources: oil, natural gas, coal, uranium, copper, iron, food, water, and everything else. This explains, for example, such phenomena that have been dominating the news as the struggle between China and Japan for the islands of the East China Sea. Now, this was the headline, people in the radio can't see it, from The Economist last week's Economist magazine. The headline is, "Could China and Japan really go to war over these?" And it points an arrow to two little islands. Well, of course they're not going to go to war over these uninhabitable little islands. What they'll go to war over is the surrounding area holds large reserves of oil and natural gas. And both of these countries, China and Japan, are desperately in need of new reserves of oil and natural gas. That's what they might go to war about if they go to war. So those disputes in the East China Sea are resource disputes. The same is true in the South China Sea, where China is competing with the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, and Indonesia for control of the Spratly Islands and the Paracel Islands. Again, it's not the islands that anybody cares about. They're uninhabitable. Many of them are covered by water at high tide. It's the surrounding subsea areas that house, again, large reserves of oil and natural gas. That's just one example of what I see. Others that are in the news are the growing assault on the Arctic region. If you've been following, the New York Times has been describing the invasion of Greenland. Because of the melting of the ice cap, it's now easier to get at the mineral reserves of Greenland and in the surrounding waters, large reserves of, again, oil and natural gas. Also, more activity in Alaska, offshore Alaska. Shell Oil has been trying to drill there. Shell's activities have been in the news. In northern Siberia, there has been increasing pace of activity. Other examples of what I'm describing are an intensified struggle for what remains of the Amazon, for control over the mineral resources of Afghanistan and Mongolia and the Congo. In this country, too, we see evidence of what I'm describing, with growing struggles in parts of this country between farmers and oil and gas interests for control of water supplies to conduct either farming or fracking, hydraulic fracking. When you hear the term fracking, always put the word hydro in front of it. It's hydraulic fracking, fracturing, and you need water to do that. As much as 10 million gallons of water per frack in order to conduct those activities, to release oil and natural gas from shale rock. And water, as a result of the drought this summer, has become exceedingly scarce in areas of high fracking activity in Texas and Pennsylvania and North Dakota. So there's intense competition between farmers and frackers, and that could only grow. That's closely related as well, of course, to the struggle over the Keystone XL pipeline, which will heat up again after the election, depending on who wins. President Obama has opposed up until now completion of the pipeline because of the danger it poses to the environment. If he gets elected, reelected, there'll be stronger opposition. Mr. Romney says he'll approve it on day one. That will produce opposition. These are other examples of what I'm talking about. Water is also increasingly a source of conflict in parts of the world where water is scarce for other purposes, for drinking and farming. China and India are worried about the diminishing supply of water from the Himalayas, where the glaciers are melting, and there's been talk of possible conflict over the headwaters of the Brahmaputra River, which is crucial to both of them. Israel and Jordan and Syria and Lebanon have threatened war over the water supplies of the Jordan River. Egypt and Sudan and Ethiopia have talked of conflict over the water supplies of the Nile River, which is essential to all of them. I can go on with many other examples of disparate events that are reported daily in the press but are not viewed as connected events. I see them as connected events. as part of a global struggle between giant corporations, governments, warlords, indigenous peoples, and other entities to gain control over what remains of the world's vital resources for human life, industry, and everything else. So what is the race for what's left? This is, as I say, an intense international struggle for remaining resources. And I have to say a little bit about why at this moment in time the struggle has acquired such intensity. Now, competition over resources is not a new phenomenon in human history. If you study human history and human conflict, go back to the earliest documents we have, for example, the Bible and the most ancient written texts from the ancient Near East and Egypt, you will know that people, humans, have been fighting over land and water for a very, very long time. And I was talking with Lee Webb, and I know a little bit about the history of Maine, and people have been fighting here for water and timber and land and furs for as long as we know. This is not new. However, I believe we're in a period now in the 21st century of accelerated competition and struggle for a variety of reasons. And let me take a few minutes to summarize these. I don't want to take too long at this, but I do think that there are a number of reasons why this struggle has acquired new intensity right now. A few of these are on the demand side. One most obvious is the growth in world population. Don't have to spend a lot of time at this, but just to put it in perspective, when I was born in the 1940s, and I think many people here can think of back that far, there were about 2 billion people on the planet. Now there are 7 billion people on the planet. So we've added 5 billion people in that amount of time, and it's been some struggle to feed and house all of the additional humans that have come along since then. We've managed to do that, but in that time, we've put most of the arable land on the planet into cultivation. We've dammed most of the rivers that are available for irrigation purposes have been put to that purpose. There isn't a lot of rivers left for damming for irrigation. There isn't a lot of arable land left for that purpose. And now we face the potential of an additional 2 billion people over the next 25 years or so being added to the population, and it's very unclear where the additional food is going to come from and water. And if you consider the impact of climate change, which may make it even harder to feed and supply with water the population we have now, you could see that we're going to face a very difficult and uncertain time simply with the most basic of resources, food, land, and water. But it's not just population growth we have to worry about. It's also the consuming habits of a world population that's increasingly affluent and has high aspirations. We have seen in our lifetimes the expansion of industrialization and urbanization and consumeritis to vast areas of the world that were agricultural when I was born, and many of us were born 30, 40, 50 years ago. To now, industrialization has spread to China, to India, to Brazil, Mexico, many parts of South America and the Middle East and Asia. And with industrialization and the rise of cities and the rise of middle class has come an aspiration to duplicate the kind of way of life we have here. That is ownership of cars and air conditioners and flat screen TVs and computers and everything else. All of this generates an extraordinary demand for resources at all at once, all over the world, on an unprecedented scale never before seen in human history. And this is what's really pushing things to the limit. I'll just give you one example of what I'm talking about. Right now, there are about 60 to 70 million cars in China compared to about 700 million cars in the United States. But the prediction is that China will have about 250 million cars by 2020 and about 750 million cars, the amount we have, by 2040. Now, if those cars are like the cars we have today, the demand for oil will so far exceed the world supply that the U.S. and China will be fighting each other for every last drop of oil left on the planet. That would be my prediction, because there just isn't enough oil left in the world to supply all of our cars and all their cars. And that doesn't take into account India, which is following along closely, and Brazil and Mexico and everyone else. That's just to fuel these cars, not talking about the steel and the aluminum and the tin and the rubber and everything else. So this is the problem that we face. It's not just population, but also growing world affluence. Set that against the other side of the coin, which is depletion. And I have to talk about depletion for a bit. Now, some of you are familiar with the expression peak oil, or have learned a bit about the problems we have with the depletion of raw materials. The picture we face is a little bit different than you may be familiar with. It's not that we are exactly running out of things. There's plenty of everything left on the planet, for the most part. What's different is that everything that's easy to extract is now gone, and gone forever. I'm talking about non-renewable resources. All of the liquid petroleum, the kind that comes spurting out of the ground in a gusher, is now gone. All of the easy iron and copper and coal and natural gas and uranium is now gone, or it's in production in mines that will soon be depleted. There is oil and natural gas and coal and uranium left, but it's either in the Arctic. About a third of the world's remaining oil and natural gas is in the Arctic. Another large percentage is in the deep, deep oceans under a mile of water. Or it's in war zones like Iraq. A lot of the world's remaining copper and iron is in Afghanistan or in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is to say it's places that you go at risk of life. So there are materials that are left, but they are all in places that are hazardous. Hazardous either to life or to the environment. So in this country, what remains of our oil and natural gas, most of it is trapped in shale rock. You can extract oil and natural gas from shale if you don't care about the nation's water supply. If you're willing to give up our nation's water, we can frack the hell out of shale, and we can have more oil and natural gas. North America's largest supply of hydrocarbons is bitumen, trapped in the tar sands of Alberta, 1 trillion barrels of oil equivalent. The problem with that is it's not a liquid, and it's impure. It's degraded petroleum. Now, you can convert it into usable liquid with all kinds of dilutants and chemical treatment, but it takes a tremendous amount of energy to do that. And in the process, you're accelerating climate change because you have to use more energy to do this. You have to gouge it out of the earth or convert it into a liquid using steam in the ground, more energy. And it's a very acidic form of oil, so transporting it is hazardous. I could go on with many other examples. There are resources left, but they're hazardous in every way. The Arctic, there's plenty of resources in the Arctic, but getting them will be extremely costly, dangerous, and pose an extreme threat to the species of the Arctic and to the indigenous people who still remain there. So the race for what's left entails an assault on difficult unforgiving, hazardous places on the planet, and the consequences of pursuing them will be extreme. So it's not that we're running out of things. I want to make that clear. There are things left, but getting at them will be produce difficulty and hazard in any direction we go. Some of this will be just cost and hazard. Shell, for example, Royal Dutch Shell, is the pioneer in trying to extract oil from the Alaskan Arctic. Last week, so far they've spent $4.5 billion to do this. Last week, for the fourth summer in a row, they had to announce defeat because their technology simply, after spending all this money, they still haven't perfected the technology to operate safely in the Arctic. And this will be the continuing saga of what I'm discussing. Governor Cuomo in New York State is quoted today about the difficulty he's facing about fracking in New York State. Well, I'm giving you examples of how problematic all of this is going to be. The environment will be a constant risk. But what I worry about most, and I'll finish with this aspect of it, is the risk of the militarization of the race for what's left, because that's what I worry about. I'm a professor of peace and conflict studies, and what I see is that in this late stage of extraction, not only will we see environmental hazards, but increasing risk of conflict arising out of the pursuit of resources in contested areas. And I worry in particular about offshore resources as we, and the Arctic. Those are the places that still have things worth extracting. But a lot of those areas, the boundaries remain undefined. The boundaries in the East China Sea, the South China Sea, the South Atlantic, and the Arctic have not been defined. And the countries that surround those areas all claim, have overlapping claims to these territories. In the South China Sea, as I said, it's China, the Philippines, the Vietnam, Malaysia. They all claim the same areas. They're all using their navies to assert their authority over those claims. Now the United States, in the persona of the president and the Secretary of State, say we're going to come to the assistance of our allies in the region, the Philippines and Vietnam, in case they're pushed, you know, they're bullied by China. So we have a risk of a U.S.-Chinese war arising out of this competition in the South China Sea between China and its neighbors for these undersea resources. And the same thing could occur in the Arctic and in other areas of contestation. We could see a similar kind of dynamic developing in Africa, where the U.S. and China are backing rival warlords and petro-dictators, petro-states, in a competition for access to Africa's oil, providing them with arms and ammunition and training and equipment and the like, and an increasingly intense struggle between the U.S. and China for those resources, getting us more and more involved militarily in the African continent. This is what worries me about this late stage of the struggle for what's left of the world's resources. And if we continue to go down this path, I can't see how we're going to be able to avoid increasing friction, crisis, and conflict. And in my mind, the only way to escape this path is by developing an entire new economic model that ceases its reliance on non-renewable resources and switches entirely to reliance on renewable resources, on efficiency, on new building materials that don't require things that are going to run out, that emphasize efficiencies in transportation and construction and in industrial processes and so on. And in fact, I think that we're already seeing signs around the world of countries or parts of countries, regions within countries that are saying, yes, this is the way of the future, and we're going to take leadership in this direction. So I end my book by talking about not the race for what's left, but the race to adapt. And I argue, and I believe this to be the case, that the time will come when the winners in the world economy will be those countries or corporations or states of the union or provinces, whatever, that say we're going to be the winners in the race to adapt and pioneer, master the new technologies of the future, create the cities of the future, and be the ones who hold the patents on these new technologies. And those countries and states and corporations that fail to move in this direction, I believe, will be the losers and will fall back in the world economy. And I think it's not hard, if you apply this perspective, to see who the winners and losers are at this stage. You could see how Germany and Denmark have pioneered in the development of green energy technologies. And California has moved very rapidly in this direction. And parts of China are moving in this direction, whereas other places in the United States and in the world are clinging to the obsolete technologies like coal, and I believe will fall back. So to conclude, I fear that if we cling to the old technologies based on non-renewable technology and the old processes that are built around them, we're going to see more conflict, more climate change at an accelerating pace with greater damage to our society. And only by converting to a new economy, a new technology based on renewables and new ways of creating our economy, organizing our economy and living, can we escape that, but that there will be competition in that transition and there will be winners and losers. And I want to make sure that we in this country are among the winners. And I want to leave you with that thought and hope that my comments have triggered a lot of thoughts among you and questions, and I welcome your feedback and also your disagreements. But thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Michael. I can imagine it is certainly going to generate a lot of questions. We'll start as the questions come in. Let me ask you one thing that somebody mentioned, and that is there any role, any practical role in what you're talking about, either in divvying up what's left of the resources or going into new technologies? Is there any role in international organizations or the UN?
I try to think about that. There is certainly a role for regional organizations, Mac. For example, one of my biggest worries is conflict over water. So in Asia, in Africa, the regional organizations could play an important role in negotiating regional water basin management. There's something, for example, called the Mekong River Commission, which China has not joined. But if China were to join the Mekong River Commission, that could avert conflict there. There's something called the Nile River Basin Initiative, which has no real powers yet. But that could be a very promising form of cooperation. What we need in Asia is agreement among the members of the East China Sea and especially of the South China Sea. ASEAN could play an important role in settling that conflict. But I think regional organizations more than international ones.
Okay, how about this? This is sort of getting into futuristic ideas. To what extent would a technological invention, for example, the questioner asked, running a car on water, completely change the picture?
I get questions like this, and I know here in Maine you're a little distant from cities, and so you think about cars. But I tell you, I don't think that saving the automobile should be our highest priority. Our highest priority, you know, 2/3 of the world's population lives in cities, or will be before long. And we don't want them to have cars. We don't want them to have cars in cities. Cars in cities are catastrophic. What we want is smart public transportation that's affordable, desirable, cheap, and efficient. That's got to be where the technology grows. Sorry. That said, you know, cars of the future have to be made out of things other than metal. So, and now my mind went blank for a minute. The Rocky Mountain Institute. Somebody help me. Avery Lovins. Yes, is talking about cars that are hybrids, but that are made out of high-strength silicon and new materials. I spoke about new materials. I think the future of technology is going to be new materials made out of things that are super abundant, but not steel.
Okay, since we're talking about new materials, let's talk about, these are existing, but a focus on new forms of energy. And I've got a couple questions on that. What forms do you think of renewable sources are the best to put our, well, to bet on, to put our money in? Energy, solar, wind, nuclear, water?
Okay. I've talked to many people about this question, and the response that comes back over and over again is, at this stage in the game, we don't know for sure which of these is most likely to be the best, so that we should put our money in all of them and see, you know, it's going to take another decade to see. The ones that I favor, of course, are wind and solar. I know that you're doing some work here in Maine on wave power and tidal power, and that looks very promising, but it's still 10 or 20 years before we'll know for sure. I would put money into tidal power here in Maine. There is an experiment underway. You have lots of inlets here, so Maine should be the world capital of tidal power. But we don't know for sure it's going to work. We need to test it out. Off the coast of Oregon and Washington State, they're testing out wave power. Lots of very clever thinking going into it, but none of them are yet ready for commercialization. The big issue is commercialization. Sometimes things work on a laboratory scale, but they don't make it to commercialization. An example of one of the most promising is algae fuel. Algae fuel may work. It looks very promising. You know, you can grow algae virtually anywhere, and it doesn't take much, and it doesn't damage the planet. But it's still not certain that this could be done in refineries, you know, that produce a million gallons a day. So that's one of the ones that's on the verge of maybe being very successful. The Navy is working on this, and the Air Force, to fuel their planes and ships. It's one area where the military is taking the leadership in developing new technology.
Okay, here's one that's asking, when you see your students, do you see an increase in creativity in finding answers to these questions? Is there a sort of energy and optimism from your students, from
yes,
that generation
yes,
addressing
yes.
these questions?
Yes, students are very interested. They're very interested in solutions. They're not as interested in protest activity as some of people in my generation want. My generation from the 60s wants my students to go out and go to Occupy Wall Street or something like that, because my students want to go and develop solutions. They want to set up small businesses or nonprofits to figure out how to solve things. They're very keen on that. I would say a surprising number of, well, I used to think from a zero to a surprising number of people are interested in food, growing food more sanely, without chemicals, without big industrial processes. A lot of people moving to my area, Western Massachusetts, to start farms and do intelligent farming. I have Hampshire College, where I'm based, has a farm, one of the few colleges with a functioning farm on the campus. And this is becoming a draw to students because they want to learn how to farm. This is very surprising. But students also want to do urban farming. This is a hot new topic, how to turn little backyards and scrap areas, junkyards, rooftops into farms.
Okay, here's an old-fashioned question. It seems easy to say that we should convert to new green technology, but the fact of the matter is that our form of capitalism says it's easier to just develop coal. So how do we bring our past behavior into the new world? And as a follow-up to that, this is a related question, is China, because of the heavy involvement of government in these new approaches to energy, are they likely to be ahead of our old-fashioned capitalistic approach?
That's a long one. That's a course. So forgive me if I can't. That's a fascinating question. And let's, first of all, there's no such thing as old-fashioned capitalism. Capitalism is a system of competing modes of production. That, you know, that's a class right there, okay? And within our system, there are competing capitalisms, and in China, there's competing capitalisms, and I won't give you a whole lecture on this. So right now, in this country, the natural gas producers are competing with the coal producers. Nobody is building a coal plant in this country. To whoever asked that question, people aren't building coal plants anymore because the natural gas is so cheap right now that all the new electricity plants are being powered by natural gas. So coal isn't what it used to be. And I do believe that as time goes on, coal will be in less and less demand. And I believe as we go further into the future, capitalists in California and in Oregon and in Washington State are investing very heavily, Silicon Valley people, in other renewable fuels and in these other experiments I'm talking about. They are capitalists too, and they're putting their money into the alternative kinds of energy. As they become cheaper, they will make the old-fashioned energy, old energy, less appealing, and the new energy will take over, just as railroads replace canals and airplanes replace trains. As for China, it's the same thing. China has internal contradictions, but I'll stop there.
Okay. Well, I'll give you an easy one then.
I love these questions, and I love to talk about them, and my students would love to be here and discuss them with you.
Well, how about this one? Even if, and it's written in quotation marks, global warming were proven to be a fact, would...
Ask any farmer in America.
Would this not help grow more food to feed the 9 billion people? You see the point.
Yes, I understand that completely.
I mean, perhaps in Maine, it would turn Maine into the kind of farming that you have further south now.
Yeah, but all of the scientific picture on you can't grow food without water. Whoever asked that question. The prospect of farming in America is catastrophic. Absolutely catastrophic. Now, where Maine is going to fit in, I do not know. But in the bread belt of America, in the major grain producing areas of the United States of America, the Midwest, the South, and the Plain States, the prognosis is for utter devastation because of persistent drought. And that extends up into the Canadian wheat-growing areas. The same is true of the other major grain-producing areas of the world, Australia, Argentina, and Russia. Now, there are some areas that are likely to benefit from global warming. Parts of Canada, Scandinavia, Siberia, and a few others. But the soils there are not necessarily adapted to the kind of, they're not comparable necessarily to the soil that you have in the prime grain growing areas that I've named. So the prospect of having food for 9 billion people is very bad.
Okay, this is a different question on global warming, and global warming is not written in quotation marks. Global warming is uncovering resources in certain places, and this is not related to food, such as the Arctic. Does this provide sort of benefits? Is there a benefit there from global warming in opening up natural resources in the Arctic?
Yeah. Now, this is what I'm doing my research on. What are the pluses and minuses? So it's likely that Greenland will become more available. However, the main coast will be underwater, and your homes on the coast will be worthless. So you decide.
So we should all be buying land and
you know, if the Greenland ice cap melts, Greenland will be open to mining. However, it will probably raise sea level about 10 to 20 feet. Need I say more?
Let's see if we can get a question that gives a slightly more optimistic answer. How about this one? From your perspective, what appears to you to be the strongest force for change of a sort that would maximize world peace?
The strongest benefit for world peace would be a sense that things are getting out of hand badly, and we have to cooperate to overcome them.
Okay. Is that happening yet?
There are places where it is. I think that there are people who see this need. I'm trying to think of apt examples, so it's not just me talking. I was at the APEC conference in Vladivostok 3 weeks ago. This is the most important political event that happens in Asia every year. It's sort of where the European community was a generation or so ago. They're not ready to get there yet in Asia. There's still too many differences. So at this event, the presidents of China and Taiwan were present because they talk about economic issues. The political issues aren't allowed on the agenda. And what they're saying is that if we can develop stronger economic ties, maybe we could get to the political ones in time. And some of these economic ones are such that maybe they could dampen the political ones. I'll give an example. The president of China and Japan were there, and they had talks. And, you know, and they're on the verge of war over, I don't think they're going to go to war, but they're very intense dispute over the East China Sea. And I think that they agreed privately that we have to calm this down, because since then, things have gotten a little calmer. And the demonstrations in China have been, I think the word has gone out, trade between China and Japan is more important to our economies and to growth, which is not doing so well in either of those countries, to allow this kind of nationalistic fervor to stand in the way. So what I'm trying to say is that there's a common interest in global stability that could overcome some of these schisms.
Do you think that China and the United States are aware of the potential for conflict between our two countries and are doing something at very high levels to work to avoid it?
I think we're going in the wrong direction. I think there are people. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was just in China, Mike Mullen, and I think he was doing a very good job of saying the U.S. and China are not destined to be enemies, and we should talk to each other and try to have exchanges so we get to know each other better. But the trend is bad, and I think both sides are to blame. I think the analysis that people in Washington have is that while the United States was, this is what Secretary of State Clinton has said in her speeches. I'm not making this up. This is what they say. They say that while the U.S. was preoccupied with Iraq and Afghanistan, China took advantage of our negligence to assert itself in Southeast Asia and that area, became much more active, and has been a bully, has been bullying the Philippines and Vietnam and the other countries in the South China Sea and in other areas and in the East China Sea. And because we were preoccupied, we didn't respond. I'm more or less saying what Hillary Clinton has said. I think that's probably true. And this is why President Obama then says, we are back, he says. We're back in the Pacific, and we're back to stay. And we're going to build up our forces. They're moving forces from the Middle East and Europe to the Pacific so that, and we're saying to our allies, he says, we're not going to let China bully you anymore, and we're going to stand up to China. And the problem is that the Chinese view this as a threat. They view this as containment, as encirclement, as the U.S. pushing its weight around, standing in the way of China's rise. And this is creating an anti-American fervor in China right now. The military is becoming more hostile to the United States. So it feeds. They're feeding on each other. And I think it's very dangerous. That's not to say that people on each side aren't aware of this and aren't trying to slow it down, but it's gotten much, much worse, and people on both sides are making it worse.
Well, we'll switch to, this is not a good news question either, but since you mentioned Iraq and Afghanistan, and I don't know which side the questioner would come down on, but the question is, was there, hopefully, I'm adding that, a U.S. plan to get some of the natural resources out of Iraq and Afghanistan as the reason we went in?
I'm not one of those who believe that the motive, the primary motive for going into Iraq was primarily to extract resources from Iraq. I think the primary reason for the U.S. going into Iraq was to solidify U.S. geopolitical dominance of the entire region. And this has been consistent U.S. policy going back to the Truman era. It's part of the Truman Doctrine, the Eisenhower Doctrine, the Nixon Doctrine, and the Carter Doctrine. All are revolve around a consistent bipartisan U.S. policy that the U.S. must be the most dominant power in the Persian Gulf region in order to ensure the safety of the oil flow, that's the Carter Doctrine, and not allow any hostile power to arise that could threaten U.S. dominance and the safety of the oil flow. And Saddam Hussein came to be viewed, for a while he was a U.S. ally, but then he came to be seen as a threat to U.S. interests and dominance of the region and had to be eliminated. In my view, that was the primary motive for the U.S. invasion of Iraq. There were certainly some people in the administration who were close to the oil companies, like Dick Cheney, who thought this might benefit their friends in Houston. But that was not, in my view, the primary reason.
Okay, we'll switch entirely, and this is simply a straightforward question. What is the role going ahead for nuclear energy? And, I mean, obviously it's a great role, but in terms of, dealing with the aftermath of nuclear power plant problems and all of that, do you think people are going to slow down on nuclear energy or find new ways of
Nuclear energy will be a niche form of energy for the foreseeable future until some new way of producing it arises. That will not happen in the lifespan of anyone in this room. It may happen in the lifespan of my students, but not in anyone in this room. There are plans for new kinds of nuclear energy, fusion power, thorium, nuclear reactors, kinds of reactors that don't produce as much nuclear waste, mini nuclear reactors. All of these may have a future, but they're still so experimental that they will not play a major role in producing energy for another 30 or 40 years.
Okay, we've got just time for two more questions. We could go on a long time. This has been fascinating. This one's about population. Is there a reasonable, safe way of persuading undeveloped countries to slow their population growth so that we don't add another 2 billion people over the next 20 years?
Yes, convince them to educate their girls.
Okay, well, that's an easy
and
answer.
Provide them with health care.
I doubt that we're doing it.
We've tried that, mm-hmm. and it works.
All right. How about this one? Which resources?
If that question was unclear, any country where education is extended to young girls through high school and where they're provided with sex education and reproductive control, the population plummets. And if you don't do that, it doesn't.
Well, they're trying to keep sex education out of our schools, so maybe our population will begin to go up. The last question, you don't have to answer that one, Michael. The last question is, which resources will be the first to be depleted? And the questioner has said, or let me rephrase that, the first to cause, in your concern, a major conflict, oil, water, et cetera.
The thing is that it's hard to, conventional oil has been depleted. It's gone. We're now dependent on what's called unconventional oil because the liquid stuff it's not depleted, but it's disappearing fast. And both oil and water are the cause of conflict today in parts of the world. So these things are the cause of friction and conflict at a local level, and they will be the cause of future conflict.
All right. This will be an open-ended question to end it. What's the most optimistic thing you can say about the problems that we're facing?
The most optimistic thing is the answer I gave to an earlier question is that I sense that my students and students I talk to at other colleges and universities, I speak at a lot of colleges and universities, are much more aware of these issues than most people our age are aware, and much more determined to do something about them. That's the most optimistic thing.
That's a great note to end on.
Thank you.